John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Some thoughts today on getting outside this summer as a matter of public health. We'll talk about that later this hour. We're going to check in with the health of our brave women in the Under Her Skin Breast Cancer Survivor series later as well. But first, the hunt for clues and the truth behind the downing of Malaysian flight MH17.
Measured by every international standard, responsibility for what happened rests with the country in whose airspace the aircraft was traveling. Ukraine is currently trying to distance itself from the tragedy. In Kiev, they still haven't answered the question, why did Ukraine change the airliner's route and send it over the area where the fiercest fighting was taking place?
What are Russians hearing about the crisis in Ukraine right now? That's Yevgeny Popov, host of a weekly news roundup on one of Russia's state-controlled TV channels. Translation there from the BBC. Is there a divergent reality between what the West is learning about the plane disaster and what Russians are being told? Dmitry Babich is political analyst for the Voice of Russia radio. He's on the ground in Moscow. We've had him on the program before. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
What is the official position, as citizens of Moscow would hear it, of what the government believes happened to Malaysian flight MH17?
Well, I would say that the Russian government doesn't have a single version of what happened, unlike the Western governors, which hastened to accuse the insurgents in the east of Ukraine. I went to this briefing of the Russian Defense Ministry, and there were no accusations. There were just questions. But there is no official version of what happened because it is still too early. No one has yet examined the black boxes.
Right, right. Do you believe there's any evidence that a missile did not shoot down this Boeing 777?
Well, I'm not an expert, so what I can tell you is what I heard from several experts that I interviewed. It's clear that the plane did not go down because it collided with a missile. It's clear that there was an explosion not far from the plane, and that's why there are so many holes in the metal, you know, that you see in the debris. So there are still so many riddles. What is indeed surprising is the way the politicians and the media in the West handles it. I mean, hours after the crash, the British tabloids came out with headlines like Putin has killed my son, Putin's missile, even though it was not yet clear how the plane actually came down.
Right, although I can't imagine that's terribly unexpected given the media environment today. But I take your point. Dmitry Babich, on a phone call the day of the first reports of the crash, it was reported that Barack Obama said directly to your president, look, these eastern Ukrainian separatists have advanced anti-aircraft missiles. Mr. Putin, we're not making this stuff up. Do you have a response to that? Does your government have a response to that?
Well, it is clear that the rebels have anti-aircraft weapons. You can see on the internet, the Western television doesn't like to report it, but even on the Western television, you can see the destruction in the cities like Slavyansk or Kramatorsk, where about one-third of the houses was actually destroyed by the Ukrainian aviation. So it's natural that they try to acquire anti-aircraft weapons and they use them, but it's still a mystery how anyone could shoot a civilian airliner at the height of about 10,000 meters, 33,000 feet over that area.
Why is this a mystery when a transport plane was shot down on Tuesday of the same week with the same Buk missile?
It was a military transportation plane, and it was not shot with the same missile. We still don't know which missile shot the Dutch airliner, and I'm not sure we can believe the Ukrainian government when it reports on the similarity of these missiles. The Ukrainian government lied numerous times since the beginning of this conflict, which I think is not very surprising because it's a war. And during a war, it's very difficult to demand truth from anyone. Buk missile requires actually several trucks and about 50 people to operate it with special skills. It requires a special radar based on another truck. So we still know for sure that the Ukrainian government has it. We don't know if the rebels have it. So the story is still very murky. Don't take me wrong. I'm not saying that the rebels couldn't shoot it. I think it is possible. What I don't like is the fact that we have hasty conclusions. We have the American representative in the United Nations calling the rebels armed thugs and in this way taking sides in this conflict. We have Mr. Obama saying that the missile came from the territory controlled by the rebels, although there was absolutely no photos, no footage produced why Obama believes it to be true.
But Dmitry, they can produce them. I mean, your president.
I'll just finish.
No. But let me just reiterate, because you're responding to the question I asked you before, and that is, yeah. President Putin was told by Barack Obama on a private phone call, "We know your allies in eastern Ukraine have these advanced missiles. We're not making this stuff up." Now you know how he knows that. He knows it. Why would he make something like that up? He says very specifically.
You mean Obama?
Right.
Why did George Bush make up the evidence about Iraq having nuclear weapons? Why did U.S. officials lie so many times in the course of their history? Because it's quite clear that the U.S. government is engaged 100% on the side of the Ukrainian government in the civil war in Ukraine. And what's going on in Ukraine is a civil war. Unfortunately, it seems to me that Obama, just like many leaders in the European Union, he has a wrong image of what's going on there. He thinks it's a Russian intrusion. There are just some Russian mercenaries who crossed the border. Putin can order them to go back and the war will end. No.
All right. But are you telling me that your answer to the 300 dead people on that Malaysian airliner is the U.S. lied about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
No. My answer is that obviously President Obama made some unfounded accusations. The situation is very different from what it was in 1962 when the United States was right and when it produced the photos of Soviet missiles in Cuba. Only afterwards, President Kennedy made his accusations. Now we have a complete opposite. We have the president making accusations without backing them up with any evidence. I think if any evidence is produced and if the investigators say, yes, the rebels did it, then Russia will do everything to assist international community in finding those responsible, even though I don't believe that the rebels could shoot that airliner down intentionally. They are not as evil as to do that.
Dmitry Babich is a political analyst for the Voice of Russia radio. He spoke with us from Moscow. Dmitry, thank you as always.
Thank you.
That's right. Get outside and play. But some kids act like you need a prescription for that. Here's Jody from Weddington, North Carolina.
Kids don't play outside today because they never learned how. Their parents work and they're too tired to go outside with them. And with the rise of cities and the decline of safe neighborhoods and backyards where kids can go outside by themselves and play for hours, where are today's kids supposed to go?
Sonoma, California writes, "The great adventure of childhood is no longer in the analog world of tree forts and freeze tag. It's in the ones and zeros of Instagram and Snapchat. They have traded their imaginary selves for the harsh realism of a profile." I've never seen much realism in Instagram profiles, I do have to say. Here's Caitlin in Ferndale, Michigan.
I think the reason kids don't play outside is because of public safety concerns and urban development. I'm only 25, but when I was a kid, we used to play in this field behind our house and look for fossils, all while ignorant of the concept of ownership, because that land was owned by an elderly man on the street. I feel like if there was more places for kids to play outside and explore nature in their own neighborhoods, kids would play outside more.
Where are the places your kids can play? Tell us a little bit about your neighborhood and speculate, will you, why kids won't go outside to play a little later on the program. We're going to talk about a program where doctors, as a matter of public health, are writing prescriptions for people to quite literally take a hike. How do your kids play outside? Why don't they? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Now, a day in the life. For Anita Coleman, she was dragging a bit the other day, July 7th, 2014.
It took me 2 days to do what I would normally do in a day.
But she gave herself some time, and that was smart.
Rearranging furniture, decorating, whatever. But I have no problem with that because I'm here those 2 days. I'm a little tired. No, I'm a lot tired. But it's okay.
You bet it's okay. Anita Coleman is looking at a second battle with breast cancer at age 54. Time means a lot to her these days, and that's one of the things she wants to make clear in her audio diary she's making for us here on The Takeaway. One of three women who have agreed to let us under their skin for our Living with Breast Cancer series and online community project. Chemotherapy at a hospital near her home in Los Angeles is one of her regular chores these days. That and polishing up her positive attitude through these difficult treatments. Anita Coleman, July 10th, 2014.
The family that we're born into does not always necessarily become our lifelong family. And it is such a blessing that we can choose new family members along the way. By this I mean the friends you choose that become your family. Don't take me wrong, I love my family dearly. But I also have an extended family. And what is even more wonderful, they all melt in together. They all melt in together.
I'm doing well, just trying to find my way back to being a normal Lisa.
July 7th, 2014, an entry from 46-year-old Lisa Eccles. Life has changed a lot from when we last checked in on her. She's recovering at home in Memphis from a double mastectomy.
I found out a few days later after my surgery, Dr. Vandewalt, who was the surgeon, gave me a good report and said that I don't have to have radiation and that the cancer had not spread it to my lymph node, which was a blessing from God. Trying to find my way back to being a normal Lisa.
Can I look good and have cancer? Or can I look good and be cured?
What a question from 28-year-old Crystal Miller. But she's young and full of life with valid single girl questions for her doctors about all this that she's facing. Crystal Miller, July 7th, 2014.
I have met with the radiation oncologist twice. She did say that, you know, with my skin type and stuff, it might be darker than the other. I don't know how I feel about that. I know, it's so petty. Like, you have cancer. Like, why are you worried about that? Like, but at the same time, like, can I look good and have cancer? Or can I look good and be cured? I know it's something I have to do, though, in order to give myself the best chance to not have to do this again.
Anita, Lisa, and Crystal, three breast cancer survivors find themselves in a community now. Besides sharing their stories with us, they're on call for each other and other women they meet in their hospitals and clinics, like Lisa Scholes did on July 9th, 2014.
I was able to minister to her, to tell her the procedures that I went through, and also it was like a therapy thing for me to be able to minister to someone else who's coming behind me.
We're going to hear a lot more from Crystal, Anita, and Lisa over the next few weeks. They will be sharing big details and the small things of life And you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and join our Facebook group for this project. Just go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. The political fortunes of Republicans in Georgia may hinge on whether incumbent Governor Nathan Deal can survive a series of ethics investigations related to campaign finances and allowing campaign officials to direct state policy. Deal's sudden vulnerability to his Democratic rival, Jason Carter, grandson of Jimmy Carter, might be a gauge of how likely Georgia is to slide back into the Democratic column as early as 2016 or 2018. Jean Bonner is the State House reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. She explains what Jason Carter's run for governor says about the changing Georgia electorate.
When he first announced, the thought was, well, he's very well liked. He's a rising star. But, it remains to be seen how quickly the demographics are changing in Georgia. The thought had been that more people who are registering to vote tend to vote Democratic, and the Republicans in Georgia have really focused on a white electorate that is dying off, basically. But the thought had been, maybe in 2018, the state could elect a Democratic governor again or some other statewide office holders from the Democratic Party. But now things are changing enough in relation to this ethics scandal that 2014, you can't completely rule it out.
So a year ago, it looked like Nathan Deal was a solid shoe-in Republican. And, where his coattails go, so go the state in terms of its blue and red status. But all of a sudden, tell me about this investigation that may bring some momentum here to this transformation that's already taking place.
Right. What has really muddied the waters is this ethics investigation, which has been going on now for quite a number of years, but was sort of lying dormant a bit. And then one of the cases came up for trial. A former head of the Ethics Commission who said she was retaliated against for investigating complaints into Deal's 2010 gubernatorial election, and a jury believed her, and she's won more than $1 million in a settlement. And then the state quickly settled three other cases. And then, the other shoe dropped last week of a memo that suggests that, yes, Deal's top aides were pressuring members of the Ethics Commission to settle these complaints.
So political pressure, strange memos, and all of a sudden there's settlements going on. That's the extent to which this looks a lot like the scandal for Governor Christie in New Jersey. Let's listen to Georgia's Democratic gubernatorial candidate, who you referred to, Jason Carter, speaking about this ethics investigation.
You have the governor's taxpayer-paid staff intervening on behalf of the governor's campaign. That's inappropriate. And as I said, it might be illegal. So that's clearly wrong. So to the extent that there is no barrier between the governor's campaign and the taxpayer-paid staff, that's a serious problem.
Political power, the campaign running the show in the State House, that's very much like the Christie-Bridgegate problem. What are you seeing and what are you sensing there in terms of momentum for this scandal in the state of Georgia, Jean?
Well, certainly people are beginning to pay attention to it. And I think it really started with this verdict back in April. Last week, a Republican pollster released a poll that suggested that, yeah, Carter might be ahead. That's very big. Certainly, yeah, this scandal has a lot of layers to it.
Go ahead. Call it. Do you think there's a realistic chance that Governor Deal might go down in 2014?
I think there's a possibility in a way that a year ago you would never have thought that there was a possibility. Jason Carter is very well liked. Obviously, you have these demographic changes. And unfortunately, more shoes have continued to drop in terms of this case. It looks certainly like Deal's top aides might have pressured the Ethics Commission to settle these complaints. And so then, the question is, what did Governor Deal know? When did he know it? And similarly to Bridgegate in New Jersey, he's tried to say, well, he didn't know. But, Alan Abramowitz with Emory University has suggested, how could he not know? I mean, he's a hands-on governor. He must have known what his aides were doing.
So the local pundits even are starting to scratch their heads a little bit about this one. But there might be some light for Jason Carter. Jean Bonner is State House reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, speaking with us from the great city of Atlanta. Thanks so much, Jean.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Be sure to get outside this summer. Disney's Snowman doesn't have a problem with that.
I shrink in my hand, my snow up against the burning sand, probably getting gorgeously tanned in summer.
Of course, a strong case can be made that snowmen might encounter some serious health problems in the hot summer, but not regular kids who, while sitting on couches on sedentary sunny days, tethered to digital devices for hours, may end up looking like puddles of body fat. Our partner WGBH has been exploring a pilot program underway in Massachusetts that trains pediatricians to write prescriptions for children and their families to more aggressively participate in outdoor activities. 75 pediatricians and more than 2,500 kids have been attracted to Dr. Christina Sirica's Outdoor RX program. Sirica is a pediatrician at the Massachusetts General Hospital for Children in Boston, and Adam Riley is a reporter with WGBH News who got to take a hike with the prescription participants at the Appalachian Mountain Club.
Some of the people who were on this hike had received prescriptions from their pediatrician stating basically that it would be beneficial to the kid to get outside and suggesting that the kid avail him or herself of this collaborative program, which conducts a bunch of different events in two suburbs, two trial locations around Boston, Waltham and Framingham. You can go online if you're a parent whose kid gets one of these prescriptions and find a whole host of events that you can take your child to and participate in with them. You also will get contacted by the Appalachian Mountain Club if your kid gets one of these prescriptions by people who will say, hey, we know that your doctor suggested this form of activity. Here's some of the things going on near you that you and your kid might be able to participate in.
Did you find some enthusiastic parents?
I did. I found enthusiastic parents and children, and I believe we have a little sound from a woman named Audrey Maloney, whose son Tommy had gotten a prescription from his pediatrician in this Outdoors RX program. And she explained to me why Tommy Maloney was out there hiking with me in Waltham.
Tommy has two conditions. One, he's on the autism spectrum, and nature and greenery suppose is really great for calming the person, for giving them like neurological growth and feedback. Also, Tommy has a weight problem. And even though we try to not diet but curtail his diet, he needs to get physically active and away from the addictive computers and technology.
Well, that makes some sense. How did Tommy like this, Adam?
Tommy was really, really high on the activity. We have sound from me talking with him afterward.
I really liked the little, like, not sure what they were, but they were like hollow and they had like a little bug egg inside. I thought they were really cool.
Anything else stand out?
I really liked the stick that I found.
A serious stick, right?
It was a huge stick.
A serious...
It was a gargantuan stick. It was about a 6.5-foot tall stick. It was actually a little scary, but he liked it, so...
Was that a therapeutic stick, Dr. Sirica?
Absolutely. So the benefits of being out in nature are just quite profound, actually. I mean, for one thing, when you're outside in nature, you're being physically active almost by definition, right? Being outdoors in nature has been shown to reduce stress. It increases sense of well-being. It improves concentration and impulse control, especially in the setting of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So it can be incredibly calming and soothing for kids with those conditions, but also with things like autism and disorders that are on that spectrum. You know, there are even studies that show that being outdoors in nature can speed healing after surgery, can reduce pain after surgery. You're also outdoors, you know, being exposed to sunlight. So the sun triggers a chemical reaction in your skin that activates vitamin D. And the benefits of vitamin D, we're learning, actually go well beyond an effect on bone strength, which is what I was always taught in medical school that it does. But it actually plays an important role in the immune function, even things like asthma. And I suspect a lot more that we haven't even uncovered yet.
Is it your impression that this is doctor-directed, or do providers and insurance companies and Medicare and, you know, I don't know who else here, are they enthusiastic about, you know, reimbursing for these kinds of therapies and treatments? And Dr. Sirica and Adam, either one of you.
I think we have a steep learning curve in this country right now, and I think that we are learning as we go. I think we have a major healthcare crisis. I think our debates about how to solve that crisis have really focused primarily on, you know, different ways of skinning the metaphorical cat, for lack of a better metaphor. But we're basically talking about different ways of treating conditions that we could have prevented potentially in the first place. And so one of the things that the Affordable Care Act has done is to implement some increased reimbursement, for example, of preventive health care. But it doesn't go far enough, and we need to be doing much, much more. And in the end, that will serve insurance companies well in terms of saving costs in the long run.
John, as you know, there are kids who go to the pediatrician and get a checkup and are told at the end of the checkup, or their parents are told that, say, their body mass index is a little too high, that it's problematic, that they are overweight and should in some way address that. And if you imagine being a kid like that or the parent of a kid like that, it seems to me that it would be a lot, I guess, more constructive to have a doctor say, hey, we think it might behoove your kid to get outside a little more than they are right now, than to be told instead, you know, this problem exists and you should find a way to take care of it.
You know, I've got five kids myself, Dr. Sirka, and I'm just wondering, you know, is it different the way adults respond to this kind of advice? Does a prescription deliver a certain amount of urgency? Do kids take this advice differently than adults who love to talk about my doctor guilt-tripped me about this, that, or the other thing?
I mean, I think that's one of the questions we're trying to find out. I mean, most of the studies that have been done of this so far have primarily looked at the use of prescriptions for adults, primarily exercise prescriptions. There's actually a whole College of Sports Medicine initiative called Exercise is Medicine, and they've looked at their outcomes. And, you know, they've actually gotten a good response in the sense that, you know, half to two-thirds of the people who receive those prescriptions say they're more likely to be physically active. But the benefit of doing this as a family is you're benefiting everybody, right? You know, physical activity, getting outdoors in nature is good for any child, not just a child with an elevated BMI, not just a child with ADHD, but any child, to help protect them from this, you know, burden of chronic disease that we have. And it will benefit the entire family if it motivates the family to go outside with that child.
John, I don't want to get us too off topic here, but it's worth highlighting, I think, a couple of the disincentives to outdoor activity that currently exist. You heard Audrey Maloney talk about it a little bit in that soundbite we played. There are a ton of easily accessible and very alluring electronic babysitters waiting in the home for kids to use these days, you know, not just computers, but tablets, smartphones. I have certainly in the past used those to sort of pacify my children and get them to calm down while I'm cooking dinner or working or whatever. In addition to that, I think there is, and again, I say this as a parent, there's a fear about sending your kid outdoors today for a lot of us that just didn't exist a generation ago. I mean, my parents were, as I am, you know, anxious, neurotic people, but they had no reluctance sending me outside when I was 10 years old on a bike with no helmet, telling me, you know, you can go a mile that way or a mile this way, stay away from that, you know, particular place and come back when it's dinner time. And for a lot of parents, I think that the thought of doing that today, it's almost inconceivable, which is why I think there's a real advantage in having something that carries, you know, the weight of authority that a prescription from a physician has, saying, find a way to get outside and be active there.
Thanks to Adam Riley, WGBH News reporter. Thanks so much, Adam.
Thanks, John. Good to talk to you.
And she's a pediatrician at Massachusetts General Hospital for Children and medical director of the Outdoors RX program in Boston. Dr. Christina Sirica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Lisa, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, and I just wanted to say that my kids do play outside. They play tag, cops and robbers, soccer, they ride their bikes, they're out a good portion of the day. Thank you.
Go Lisa, let's go out and play with Lisa's kids. What's the story with your children? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything else on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Time to go play. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.